stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we approach life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, 1 centimeter, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and good evening. You're listening to UBC's Sharing Science Radio, broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. On the show today, we're getting extreme. That's right, we're talking about extremophiles. These are organisms that live in a place too hot, too acidic, too small, or just too something for regular life. We'll be hearing from Jane Leo, a UBC master's student who worked on training bacteria to clean up mine tailings. We'll also have Sam getting hot and bothered with hypothermal bacteria. Nathan's going to tell us why cockroaches are winning the arms race. And I'm going to talk about pet rocks. But first, here's Sam to give us the rundown on what an extremophile actually is.
Today marks the end of September. The weather gets colder, and in order for humans to survive in colder temperatures, we have adapted ways to allow ourselves to live in environments like Canada, or Siberia, or even Antarctica, that is less than optimal for our species to live comfortably. We don't like conditions that are too hot or too cold, but if we do live in areas that reach high 40s or negative 30 Celsius, we need to find a way to cope with these extremes. Every organism on Earth faces challenging environments at one point or another, but what about life that isn't able to knit polyester clothing together or invent air conditioning? What about life that lives in extreme environments every day of the year? Well, luckily we have a name for such creatures, called extremophiles. Extremophiles are defined for their ability to not only survive, but to thrive in crazy conditions that we as humans can barely even think about. There are many types of extremes. You might have high or low temperatures, thermophiles, very low or very high pressures, barophiles, very low amounts of water, xerophiles, high acidity, acidophile, or high salt, halophiles, among many others. What makes organisms like these so special? Well, let's take Thermus aquaticus as an example. It lives in hyperthermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, reaching 90 degrees Celsius. At 90 degrees, the majority of our proteins and enzymes in our bodies would get destroyed and no longer function. Even if we didn't melt or spontaneously combust, our cells and tissues would have no chance of functioning. What makes these bacteria in these vents incredible was the evolution of many enzymes that are stable enough to retain function at these extremely high temperatures. So you might ask yourself, why bother studying bacteria that live in an environment that's not even remotely related to ours? Two reasons stand out as highly important. First, these hyperthermophiles might give us a window into how life existed in the exceedingly extreme conditions of early Earth. The mess of methane, sulfur, and high-temperature environment that first enabled life to thrive. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, depending on who you ask, these highly functional enzymes in extreme conditions are incredibly useful to scientists in the fields of genetics, biochemistry, and molecular biology. Every single day, the enzyme these extremophile bacteria use to replicate their DNA is used by scientists for the exact same purpose. With the introduction of this enzyme and a technique that earned the Nobel Prize back in 1993, labs are immeasurably more efficient at performing genetic experiments. It quite literally changed the way science was approached and performed. If you can think about an environment of any kind, there is almost certainly an organism that lives there. On the surface of Antarctica? You bet. There are plenty of bacteria, fish, insects, and plants that produce antifreeze proteins, enabling them to live in sub-zero temperatures. Can you imagine that? Organisms that aren't warm-blooded, unable to regulate internal body temperature, have adapted in a completely different way to prevent freezing. The spruce budworm tree can survive in negative 30 degrees Celsius, and perhaps most amazingly, the Alaskan beetle Upis cerambioides produces an antifreeze sugar that can enable it to survive at negative 60 degrees Celsius. How about our upper atmosphere where there is little oxygen and pressure? Of course. A study in 2010 found 340 possible species living in the stratosphere, of which 17 were found in every single sample that they had taken in different locations. But what about outer space? Well, there's plenty of reports of organisms that can survive the trip into outer space and continue living when exposed to earthly conditions again, but whether they can develop and actively live in space is at best contentious. My personal favorite are tardigrades, which we brought up in a previous show. They are actually animals and are affectionately called water bears, which have survived in the vacuum and high radiation conditions of outer space. The only thing that is currently limiting our studies on these organisms is being able to A, retrieve them from their extreme environment, and B, recreating their environment in a lab. I am hopeful that in the future we are going to be able to continue building on the already blossoming body of research on these outrageous organisms.
Thanks for that, Sam. We're now going to move on to my interview with Jane Leo, a recent graduate from UBC. I caught up with Jane to talk to her about her research concerning extremophiles that live in mine tailing ponds.
So Jane, maybe you could start off by telling us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from and how did you get to UBC?
So I'm originally from China. I went to an international high school in China, and it was a cooperation between a Chinese high school and also a Canadian high school. So in my high school, we learned two sets of curriculum, one from Chinese government, and then another one is the Canadian curriculum. So after that, I came over to Vancouver and studied at UBC for my undergrad degree. And then after that, I knew my supervisor from that and just started my master's degree with her afterwards.
So during your master's degree, what was your research all about?
My research is about wastewater treatment, but I'm trying to use anaerobic bacteria to do the wastewater treatment. And also the wastewater mainly comes from the mining industry, where there's a lot of sulfate, nitrate, heavy metals in the wastewater. And also the concentration of everything is quite high because that's the nature of their tailings pond wastewater typically.
Okay. Now, is this in a tailings pond because the concentration is quite high? Is this a harsh environment? Would you find all sorts of bacteria there?
It is actually a very harsh environment because the wastewater itself is very saline. There are a lot of chlorine and also a lot of sodium. Mainly for the wastewater I was looking at, it has a lot of sulfate and nitrate. The concentration is so high that it's very hard for any bacteria to live in that environment. It is possible that some bacteria are present, but because the mining industry uses a huge amount of water and is usually the concentrations are diluted, it will be really hard for any wastewater treatment process to treat that much amount of wastewater. So one way they figured was to trying to concentrate everything and then make some of the clean water they get, they can reuse in the process again. And then the leftover, since they have some heavy metals, they can't just release it into an environment. It will have a very huge impact on the local species and maybe reduce their population in the end. So right now, they are just sitting in the tailings pond, trying to figure out ways to how to treat it. And then the hypothesis is some bacteria may live around that tailings pond area, and also in the local environment, they might find some bacteria that can survive in that environment already. So using those bacteria, maybe they can do something about the wastewater in the tailings pond. But for my work, I still had to dilute the water from the tailings pond because it's just, everything is so high concentration and it's just very hard for anything to survive, really.
So you're trying to find a way to allow bacteria to survive in this harsh environment?
Yes, yes. Usually you have to find different ways. One of them is kind of contradictory because you have to dilute the wastewater again where they just concentrated it. Another thing is there are not a lot of nutrients for the bacteria to survive in that environment, so you have to add in more stuff like carbon source, which is mainly used for bacteria metabolisms.
Okay, so without the carbon, it's sort of like eating all salt and no food on your
dinner
plate.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay. So you said you would like to try and get these bacteria to survive in that environment. How exactly do you go about changing an organism to allow it to survive?
You have to figure out what's the major type of bacteria you're looking at and what type of environment is best suited for this type of bacteria to grow in. And then you try to grow it in this type of environment, which is not a very harsh environment, and trying to enhance their growth, increase their population, and then slowly increase the harshness of the environment.
Is it essentially like evolution?
In a sense, you're trying to concentrate the type of bacteria you want in the end, and then by eliminating all the other type of bacteria that cannot survive in the type of environment.
Okay.
In the end, you will try to use that bacteria to do your research.
So the other bacteria that you eliminate, are these different species, or are they the offspring of the original bacteria who, because of their genetic, because of their genes, they just can't survive in that environment?
Depends on what you start with. You can start with an environment sample, which has many different species of bacteria already present in the sample, or you can start with a pure culture where it's only a specific type of bacteria. So depending on what you start with, if you have a pure culture at the beginning, when you increase the harshness of the environment, you are making them more tolerant to the specific type of environment you will look at in the future. But if you start with a mixed culture in the beginning, which is the environment sample, the species that can tolerate very harsh environment will survive in the end. But if they cannot, they will just die off.
Okay. So you're essentially you're weeding out all the bacteria that you don't want.
Yes.
Okay. And what did you find after doing all these experiments? Were you able to find some bacteria that actually could survive in the harsh, extreme environment of the tailings pond?
Yes, I did. Surprisingly, I did. My original thought was trying to enhance the population of one specific type of bacteria. But in the end, since I started with an environment sample, all the bacteria work together as a community. And the type of bacteria I was looking at survived in the end, and also some other type of bacteria survived. They all work together to treat the mining wastewater. But it's hard to say how their dynamic works and how they work together with each other. I found some things that's on the same path as I predicted, but other things that did not work as I'd expected. So I still have to figure out ways to try to explain that, which will bring you further into your research, trying to look at what type of bacteria are present in your culture and what exactly they are, trying to extract their DNA, figure out exactly what kind of species they are.
Well, thank you very much, Jane.
No problem. And thank you very much for having me.
Thanks a lot, Jane. Up next, we've got Nathan telling us about extreme cockroaches.
The date is August 6th, 1945, and the world's first ever atomic bomb has been dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. What is left alive after that blast? What could have survived all that radiation? Up until the 1940s, with the advent of the bomb, we hadn't even had to ask these kinds of questions. Afterwards, people were wondering, how much radiation is lethal? Are some animals better equipped to survive than others? In particular, you might be thinking about a certain organism. You might be thinking about the cockroach. Cockroaches are very sturdy organisms and are known to survive a multitude of very harsh conditions. They can survive without air for about an hour, without food for about a month, are known to subsist on cellulose, that's wood or paper, or in a pinch on nastier things like glue or even each other. They aren't above cannibalism, it turns out. Cockroaches are also surprisingly resistant to decapitation. There are a few experiments out there which removed the head of the cockroach and found that the bug will live for another week or so until it dies of thirst. So it wouldn't be so surprising if a cockroach could survive a nuclear fallout. To this end, biologists have conducted experiments to test the cockroach's resistance to radiation. The scientists were able to do this by hitting populations of cockroaches with varying levels of radiation and observing how long it took the bugs to die. Only a little radiation and the bugs lived a normal, full life. Too much and they would all die rather quickly. Somewhere in the middle, there was this threshold, this point where if you give a cockroach anything above that much radiation, it will most certainly die. The cockroach, it turns out, is not invincible. And the limit, the absolute most radiation that a cockroach can take without dying, it turns out it's about 6 to 10 times higher than for a human. So, what's the deal with death by radiation? The key, it turns out, is cell division. Cells happen to be a lot more vulnerable to radiation damage when they're dividing than at any other time. Cockroaches only perform cell division about once per week, whereas humans have some types of cells that are dividing all the time. So, because cockroach cells divide less often, they have less opportunity for damage, and are generally better off than any human during, say, a nuclear blast. Anyways, if you look at the rest of the insect world, you'll find that cockroaches aren't unique. In fact, a week for cell division in the insect world isn't even that slow. As a result, there are other insects out there that would be far better off during a nuclear holocaust. The wood bug, or the fruit fly, or the parasitic wasp are all examples of bugs that would outlive the cockroach. The parasitic wasp, for example, can withstand about 200 times the radiation that it would kill a human, about 10 times what a cockroach can take. So, what organism is the best? Who's most likely to survive a nuclear holocaust? The answer is a bacteria called Deinococcus radiodurans. This bacteria was discovered in 1959 when people began to wonder if canned food could be sterilized using radiation. Scientists of the day exposed tins of meat to massive doses of radiation, but were puzzled when the meat still spoiled. The culprit was Deinococcus radiodurans. The bacteria survived the sterilization and proceeded to feed on the meat, causing it to go off. The key to D. radiodurans' survival in the face of radiation again comes back to its cellular processes. That particular bacteria keeps multiple copies of its own genome. When a gene is damaged by radiation, healthy portions of the copies are spliced or merged together in order to form a single healthy gene. And the bacteria is capable of doing this very, very quickly. It can repair breaks in its DNA in a 12 to 24-hour period. As humans, DNA repair takes us a lot longer. Finally, why does all this cell science matter? Well, imagine for a moment that you are a cockroach, and you have a nasty growth on your shell. Imagine that you have a human finger growing fast and out of control on your back, and it was alarming, and you're thinking, what is this evil, horrible thing on my back? And you go to the cockroach doctor, and he says that left unchecked, these fast-growing human tumors that sometimes show up in cockroaches, they can be fatal. His medical advice is, scuttle down to the nuclear power plant, crawl right into the nuclear core, and just kind of hang out a bit. Don't stay there long enough to kill yourself, of course. Just stay until that finger, that nasty collection of human cells, dies, and then you'll be fine. Well, that cockroach doctor has just described what we humans know as radiation therapy. It's a type of cancer treatment, and we use it to kill cancer cells, which divide a lot faster than our normal human cells. A typical treatment will radiate a cancer tumor, killing the malignant cells, but sparing many of the patient's healthy cells, which aren't as vulnerable.
Thanks, Nathan. In the 1970s, the pet rock was introduced. It turned out that not being alive was actually a pretty good trait for a pet. But you could say that some rocks actually are alive because some rocks are full of tiny organisms that live inside them. On a microscopic level, many rocks, such as sandstone, are full of tiny cracks and holes. And these are holes that are smaller than the width of a human hair. This makes a perfect home for organisms called endoliths. Long ago, endoliths squeezed themselves into rocks and clay, and that's where they've been chilling ever since. What's absolutely nuts about these organisms is where we find them. scientists have found endoliths living inside rocks 3 kilometers underground. And this discovery was like something right out of Lord of the Rings. You know, the dwarves are digging the mines of Moria through the misty mountains, and boom, they run straight into a Balrog. In our world, we're digging a gold mine in South Africa, and boom, we run straight into an endolith. Of course, not quite as scary as a Balrog. You can't even see them because they're so small, but they're there, and it's an example of how adaptable microorganisms can be. And many endoliths are extremophiles because deep inside rock or clay, there's no air. And endoliths have to use funky chemical reactions to grab chemicals right out of the rock for energy and food. And because it's so difficult to live down there, their life cycles are extremely slow. Some of them reproduce once every 1,000 years. And there's a limit to how deep they can go because of the heat. Nothing on Earth, not even extremophiles, have been found that can survive above 121 degrees Celsius. But maybe endoliths could survive inside asteroids in outer space and then travel between solar systems and spread life. Well, at least that's the idea behind something called panspermia. Might sound kind of weird, but I don't think it's any weirder than a pet rock. Don't go away. We've got a quick break coming up. After that, we'll have some more Sharing Science Radio coming right at you.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you're seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
Welcome back to Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to have a quick discussion now about what we learned before the break. Now, we had an interview with Jane Leo, and she was a master's student here at UBC who was working on using bacteria to clean up mine tailing ponds. And it turns out that there's actually some of this bacteria that's pretty close to Vancouver. Is that right, Sam?
I think some of the bacteria that's used in the mining industry is found in the Britannia mine that's in Squamish. That's on the Sea to Sky Highway for anybody that likes to spend a lot of time in Whistler.
Oh, man, I've always wanted to stop there. Have you guys been there before?
Yeah, as a kid, I went down into the mines, ate some bacteria.
Yeah. You're stronger for it, I think.
You very likely breathed it in if you've spent any time inside that copper mine of Britannia. So that's the niche that those bacteria live in. That's where it makes its 9-to-5 job and pays the bills.
What does it do?
What it's really good at doing is it takes the place of some of the manual labor that humans no longer have to do. So you've got these different metal ores that are inside this this mine. So, for example, with Britannia, we have copper. But not only is there copper inside these mines, but there's also sulfur-containing molecules that are either caked inside the copper, or it's really just polluting the copper that so it's not being able to be used by humans. But what this bacteria is really good at doing is extracting all of those contaminating sulfur compounds and actually using that in order to live. So not only is the bacteria almost purifying the copper for us, but it's proliferating and it's able to exist there naturally over the course of many thousands and probably likely tens or 100,000s of years.
Probably millions of years.
Absolutely, yeah.
So in not very long, we could have a productive copper mine over there again.
Maybe we could. The only bad thing about it is that when it releases all the sulfur from the copper, it becomes sulfuric acid. And if anybody knows anything about sulfuric acid, it is extremely acidic and extremely toxic to the water that it's then... So that's part of the tailing ponds and the runoff that occurs from these mines is that they've got these polluted, very acidic, very highly metal consisting ponds that are no longer accessible to a lot of earth or a lot of organisms, which make this specific type of bacteria what we call an extremophile. It's able to survive in a condition that most other organisms are unable to.
So that's pretty cool. And obviously we're being in BC with a lot of resources. We're pretty familiar with mines and tailing ponds. In fact, there was one in the news not that long ago because it actually broke. A big problem with separating things is how do you go about doing it? And Jane in her in the interview talked a little bit about some mechanical and chemical separation, but biological separation is great because
as Jane said, you don't have to add anything except you just have to introduce the species in there and they will proliferate and live on their own. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of putting them to work for us.
It's amazing what life can do so much better than the inventions that humans have made that's non-life oriented. So let's take, for example, the organisms that I talked about living in Antarctica. These bacteria, these fish, these plants, these insects are all producing antifreeze proteins. And these proteins are actually 200 times more effective per molecule than the chemicals that we put into our cars for de-icing our windshields. Can you imagine that? That the life is able to do something so much better than what we've created in the past 10 years. And when you consider the context of these bacteria evolving over the course of thousands, tens, hundreds, millions of years, then it makes sense that these are so specifically designed to do their function that they obviously would be better than what we can come up with in 10, 15, or 20 years.
It's amazing what's in the biological world. I mean, so often you find that nature has done it before and done it better than we can do it. And the reason we're using our crude mechanical or chemical techniques is because we just aren't able to access the proteins or synthesize those in enough quantity to fill up our cars with.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Maybe one day we'll be using bacteria as our windshield wiping de-icing fluid.
Yep, maybe, you know. could be good.
I don't see why not.
Yeah, why not? Okay, so let's go back to these bacteria that live in tailings ponds, for example, since we've talked about these a lot. Now, I got maybe kind of a dumb question for you guys, but why would the bacteria decide to live in a tailings pond? I mean, it's basically like deciding to live in a crappy neighborhood in a rundown shack just because no one else is there. Why would they decide to do this?
Well, they could just call it quits and commit suicide, I guess.
Can a bacterium commit suicide?
Well, I guess what I mean is they, you know, why would you not live? Maybe they don't have a choice, is what I'm saying.
That sounds about right. In the context of evolution, it's not that they're making a conscious choice to do something. It's just that in previous generations of that species, they got better and better at surviving in an environment that was less populated, or at least where there was a niche, an opportunity for these organisms to flourish and live. So obviously they're going to, over time, you would expect them to get better and better at surviving in either the extreme conditions of the bottom of the ocean, where a lot of organisms are unable to, or some other condition.
Wherever, you know, in the atmosphere, up high, which is crazy.
Wherever they're forced to live, they will find a way to live, just as we have, spreading into Antarctica.
So it's kind of like they got dealt lemons, and they started making lemonade, and it turns out they really like lemonade in the end.
Yeah, and you can live on lemonade for the rest of your life.
If you're an extremophile.
If you're an extremophile.
Right, yeah. And love it.
Yeah. If there's an opportunity for something to live, it certainly will.
And that's interesting because there's opportunities. Life finds a way and, you know, squeezes its way into every little niche. But then you got to ask, what are the limits? You know, like what? Where are the boundaries that life, you know, you shall not pass this line? Where are the boundaries?
That's a great question. And I don't think anybody really has an answer to something like that.
From what I said this in my story, but I've heard that no organisms have been found that can survive above 121 degrees Celsius. So, you know, carbon-based life forms, which all these organisms are, perhaps that is an upper limit to them. But in terms of other extremes, such as too cold or too salty or too acidic, what are the limits for those guys?
And how many times in the past have we you know, found what we thought was a limit that turned out to be, you know, later disproven by, you know, we find a new thing that lives beyond those limits.
Right, right.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
We're really only limited to finding these organisms because we just can't see them. We haven't found a method in which for us to observe them. Because it's not like that. It's not easy for us to go down to the bottom of the ocean and then take these bacteria that can live in 90 degrees Celsius temperature and bring them back, culture them, and actually see that they're living.
Well, we better wrap it up here. We've covered some interesting topics today. Thank you very much to Jane Leo, who provided us with that excellent interview. Thanks to Sam and Nathan for joining us. I'm Alan Manning, and
and you've been listening to Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned. Next is Sam Squanch's Hideaway.